Inside the Game with Pat Williams is a pre-recorded show.
It's time once again for Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams. This is AM 950, FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. And we're always so pleased when you join us. So is Jeff Sennis. He's our engineer. Andrew Herdliska produces the show. And I want to introduce you to Seth Stevens Davidowitz. He's up in North Jersey, New York Times op-ed contributor, visiting lecturer at the Wharton School in Philadelphia, and author of Who Makes the NBA? Data-driven answers to basketball's biggest questions. Seth, welcome to Orlando. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks so much for having me, Pat.
Tell me about this book. How did it come about, and what's the mission here?
So I've been obsessed with basketball since I was about probably 8 years old. I grew up in New Jersey area, rooting for the Knicks of Patrick Ewing and Charles Oakley and Anthony Mason, John Starks. So I'm a huge basketball fan. I'm also a data scientist. And I actually, what the genesis of this book is, I became obsessed with AI tools, artificial intelligence, and how they could kind of speed up my data analysis process. So I just played around with all these AI tools and created a book that I'm really proud of all these big questions in basketball that I've always been interested in, what it takes to make the NBA, how much height influences success in NBA, why certain countries produce more NBA players, all kinds of questions that I've been thinking about since I was 8 years old but never really been able to answer. But thanks to AI and data analysis, I was able to answer them. And I had the most fun I've ever had working on this book. It was a pure joy, and I'm really happy with how it turned out.
Seth, let's dive in. What players are systematically undervalued in the draft?
So one of the things I found is that there are certain the draft, you know, you kind of one of the big questions in basketball is the draft efficient or can you beat it? And I think it's undeniable in the data that you can beat the draft, that some teams know what they're doing and they consistently have better draft players that outperform their draft rank. And some teams have no idea what they're doing, and they systematically underperform their draft rank. And there are many things that kind of predict overperformance or underperformance. One of them is hand size. So it's long been known that hand size is really important in basketball. You want players with big, wide hands who can palm the ball. Phil Jackson once said if you had to pick one player, Michael Jordan or Kobe Bryant, he'd pick Michael Jordan because Michael Jordan had big hands and Kobe didn't. So we know that big hands matter, but it's very clear in the data that teams just have not realized just how much it matters. So Kawhi Leonard's a famous example of someone who outperformed his draft spot. And part of the reason is just his enormous hands, which give him a huge advantage on the court. There are all kinds of inefficiencies. Another one I found is players who are big-time high school recruits. So Carlos Boozer, Trevor Ariza, they're top 20 recruits. Everybody wants them out of high school. And then in college, that for whatever reason, people decide, maybe they're not so good, and they fall the second round. You really want to draft these players. These players consistently outperform their draft pick. I kind of conclude in Who Makes the NBA, the book, that the world should go with its first instincts more. You know, if the world decides in high school this is a can't-miss prospect and then decides in college, well, I don't know, he might have these weaknesses, that weaknesses, they were right the first time.
Next topic. Are clutch shooters born or made?
I think a little bit of both. I studied what makes a good clutch shooter, and one thing that's very interesting in the data is the average NBA player shoots one percentage point worse in clutch moments. That's defined the games within 5 points, 5 minutes or less remaining on the clock. So what causes this? And it turns out there are just some players who really stink. Basically, they're terrible in the clutch, and some players are unaffected. They're the same whether it's clutch or non-clutch. So Jimmy Butler is an example of that. You know, a free throw in the beginning of the game, nobody's paying any attention, and a free throw with 3 seconds left, you know, a tie game, Jimmy Butler has just the same, exactly the same chance of making it in any of these situations. And one thing that's also interesting is there's no evidence that anybody gets better in the clutch. So NBA players are divided between players who remain exactly the same and players who can't handle the moment, who get worse. And one of the things that I found that is an interesting predictor of kind of choking, being bad in the clutch, is being really tall, which is a big theme in who makes the NBA, that tall players, just because there are so few seven-footers in the world, it turns out 1 in 7 seven-footers reaches the NBA, which is a shockingly large percent. Literally, if you're 7 feet tall, you have a 1 in 7 chance of becoming an NBA player, just an enormous chance. And what this means is that if you're 7 feet tall, you don't have to be that great an athlete. You just have to be the top 1 in 7. So taller NBA players tend to be much slower, lower vertical jump, worse shooters, and they're also worse in the clutch. Finn Baker is a classic example, the big power forward, shot about 16 percentage points worse in clutch moments than non-clutch moments, really just unable to handle the moment. And I think one of the reasons these huge guys are bad in clutch moments is, again, they don't have to be as good because the selection pressure is a lot lower on them because there just aren't enough seven-footers to find people who really are psychologically the toughest in the world.
Seth Stevens Davidowitz has written the book, Who Makes the NBA? Data-driven answers to basketball's biggest questions. What percent of seven-footers are in the NBA? Do you think you've covered that thoroughly?
Yes, it's 1 in 7. But one of the things that's interesting about height is each inch doubles your chances of making the NBA throughout the height distribution. It's really wild. So if you're 6'1" tall, you have twice the chances of making the NBA as if you were 6 foot exactly. If you're 6'2", you have twice the chances of making the NBA as if you were 6'1", all the way out to 7 feet tall. And what that means is there are just enormous differences in your probability of reaching the NBA based on height. If you're 5'10 or below, 5'10 is the height of an average male. I'm about 5'9", if anyone's curious. If you're 5'10 or below, you have a 1 in 3.8 million chance of making the NBA. And as mentioned, if you're 7 foot or above, you have a 1 in 7 chance of making the NBA. So 1 in 3.8 million if you're below average height, a 1 in 7 if you're 7 feet tall. So I think some people don't realize just how much height matters in reaching the NBA.
Why do some countries produce so many more NBA players than others?
So I studied this. There are lots of one thing that was interesting in the data that surprised me a little bit is there are actually some countries now that produce more NBA players on a per capita basis than the United States. So the U.S. Virgin Islands, Montenegro, there are parts of the world that now are producing NBA players at even a higher rate than the United States, where the NBA was founded and is played now. There are lots of things that come into it, but there are some that were surprising. One of the ones I found most interesting that predicts how many NBA players a country produces is the popularity of volleyball. Mm. That's actually a negative predictor. If volleyball is very popular in a country, it produces way fewer NBA players, and particularly NBA forwards, because NBA small forwards, 6'8", 6'9", they have the same body as an ideal volleyball player. So if you grow up in Bulgaria, Brazil, Puerto Rico, Italy, an area where volleyball is very popular and more popular than basketball, and you grow to be 6'8", 6'9", 6'10", instead of playing basketball, you're going to play volleyball. So if volleyball is really popular in a country, they kind of take all the potential NBA talent, NBA forward talent, and shift them into the preferred sport of volleyball, which is actually terrible for the volleyball players because they make way less money than they would as NBA players.
Very interesting. Now, who would be the best NBA player of all time if every player were the same height?
Yeah, so this is one of my favorite questions in Who Makes the NBA. I, as mentioned, am 5'9" on a good day, I'd say. So maybe I'm a little bitter that, you know, if you rank the top 10 players, take a list of the top 10 NBA players of all time, the average height of those men is about 6'10". You know, you have Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Wilt Chamberlain and Shaquille O'Neal and Tim Duncan, just enormous men gracing the top of the list of best players of all time. So I did some fun math, fun for me. I'm, as mentioned, a total data geek, as you can probably guess from this conversation. I did a whole bunch of math to find out who would be the best player if everybody were the same height. And, I, you know, you can read in the book how I do this. But I conclude with Muggsy Bogues, who is 5'3". I think people just don't give enough credit to Muggsy Bogues. The accomplishment, he was an NBA player for 14 seasons at 5'3" tall. Just an insane, insane accomplishment. And he ranks, you know, I think, you know, we think, you know, who's the best player of all time? Michael Jordan. Some people say LeBron James. And they're supposed to teach us about discipline and mastering your craft. But I think in many ways what Muggsy did was even more impressive from the perspective of mastering your craft and discipline and hard work, because height is just so important in basketball at every position. To make it 14 seasons, even if he wasn't a star, he was a competent player for 14 years, a starter for 9 seasons at 5'3" tall. Just an insane, insane accomplishment. And I think the math shows that if he were the same height as every other player, Muggsy would be the best player. But unfortunately for him, he was only 5'3", so he never really became a superstar.
My guest, and boy, is he fascinating, Seth Stevens Davidowitz. And when we've got to take a break, and when we come back, first question, what percent genetic is basketball talent, and how does this compare to other sports? We're talking with Seth. His book, Who Makes the NBA? Data-Driven Answers to Basketball's Biggest Questions. This is Inside the Game. We gather like this every weekend, and we get to talk sports with some really intriguing people. I'm your host, Pat Williams. We've been doing it for many years, and always so glad when you join us. You're listening to AM 950, FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. We'll be right back. This is Seth Stevens Davidowitz, Who Makes the NBA? That's the name of his book. And as I mentioned before the break, Seth, are you ready? What percent genetic is basketball talent, and how does this compare to other sports?
So basketball talent, I calculate, is 80% genetic, which is much higher than other sports. Football, it's more than twice as genetic as football and baseball. The clue to how genetic basketball is the prevalence of identical twins. The NBA has been dominated by identical twins. You know, no other league is comparable, just how many identical twins are in the league. The prevalence of identical twins is a dead giveaway that something's very genetic, because identical twins share 100% of their genes. So if one identical twin gets a really good draw of genetics, the other identical twin's going to get that same draw. And one of the reasons that basketball is so reliant on genetic is the importance of height, which I mentioned earlier, where, you know, each inch doubles your chances of making the NBA. And height is highly genetic. You know, fathers are pass their height on to their sons in a large amount. So basketball is far more genetic than basically any other sport we can test. Certainly the major American sports, baseball and football, is not even close. Basketball is just so much more reliant on genetics than these other sports.
Let's move to this one. What advantages do NBA player fathers pass on to their sons?
Well, the first thing that NBA fathers pass on to their sons is genetics, as mentioned earlier. So, you know, Manute Bol is 7'6" tall. Bol Bol, his son, is 7'2" tall. So, you know, the average person is not going to be that tall. Manute Bol has a lot of genes for height that he passed on to his son. But there's something more subtle that fathers give their sons. And I looked at how do sons of NBA players compare to other NBA players in Who Makes the NBA? And I found the biggest difference was they're great, great shooters. So on average, sons of NBA players shoot free throws about 5 percentage points higher, which is a very noticeable, significant difference. And 8% of the best free throw shooters of all time have been sons of NBA players, including the best of all time, Steph Curry. Of course, his dad was Del Curry, an NBA player for the Charlotte Hornets. And why is this? Why are sons of NBA players such good shooters? I think it's because their fathers teach them great shooting form from a very young age. And there are stories of, you know, Devin Booker, his father was in the NBA and said he always shot with perfect form. I insisted on it. Jalen Brunson, his father was in the NBA. There was recently a video that went viral where you see his father just hammering over the importance of habits. Shoot it right, shoot it right, shoot it right. So, you know, starting from the age probably 3, 4, 5 years old, sons of NBA players are taught how to shoot and master their form. And this shows up in them being extraordinary, extraordinary shooters.
Seth, the next question, how much do NBA coaches matter?
A lot. I think this is an area where there hasn't been that much data analysis, but recently my own data analysis, other data analysis from professors at the University of Chicago, they found that NBA coaches matter a lot and matter more than other sports, more than football, more than baseball. And I think one of the reasons for that is that the NBA has kind of an incentives problem, which is players have an incentive to shoot too much, to score points, even if it doesn't help the team. And coaches can be really important in getting players to be basically less selfish, to do what's in the interest of the team, not what's in their own personal interest.
What exactly do the best coaches do?
I think that's a little bit of a mystery. So one of the things they definitely, the outcome they affect is they get players to pass the ball. So I have a metric in Who Makes the NBA of how much a given player passes the ball when they're coached by a given coach. And the best coaches, whether it's Greg Popovich, Jerry Sloan historically, players pass the ball a lot more when they're coached by them than coached by other coaches. How do they do this? It's a little bit of a black box. We don't know. But there seems to be, one of the things that's interesting, there's a biography of Greg Popovich, the legendary coach for the San Antonio Spurs. And he spends about as much time on non-basketball things as basketball things. So a lot of what he does is just bring the team together, hosting dinners. He hugs them all the time, makes them feel loved, part of something bigger than themselves. I think that's a bigger part of basketball and certainly a bigger part of coaching than we sometimes acknowledge. I think coaches, the X's and the O's, may be less of what makes a great coach great than we sometimes think. But the culture that they build, the getting people to care about the team, to sacrifice for themselves, that is a really, really important part of coaching, probably the crucial part of NBA coaching.
My guest is Seth Stevens Davidowitz. He is a New York Times op-ed contributor, a visiting lecturer at the Wharton School. We're talking about his book, Who Makes the NBA? Seth, I am curious about your lecturing experience at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. How does that work for you? Do you commute? Who are you teaching? Who are these students?
So I've taught basically business data analysis of business. So how businesses can use big data, because that's kind of my specialty. I was working before I started writing. I was working as a Google data scientist. So a lot of my expertise is in how businesses can use data analysis. But this book was less about business and more about a personal passion project, which is just the data of basketball.
Tell me about your work at the New York Times.
So I've written a column for a while, wrote a column for a while, where I just analyzed various questions of data that I found interesting. Everything from where famous people are more likely to be born to what age we get hooked on music, just a lot of, interesting questions. It's all about how much we can learn from data, which is kind of the theme of this book as well, the theme of my career. There's so much data out there now that, you know, a lot of questions that have been unanswerable are now answerable. And that's kind of similar, you know, to this book is, you know, there's so many things that are interesting about basketball that, you know, now it's so easy to collect data, to analyze data. I use a lot of artificial intelligence to help me in this book. And I also say how I used artificial intelligence in the book. And all this, you know, all these new tools allow us to really have a crack at questions that previously have been unanswerable.
Seth, can you explain artificial intelligence to us old timers?
I think it's hard for anybody to fully understand artificial intelligence. Even the people who create the models don't fully understand how they work. But the outcome is kind of a revolution in our work process, you know, and how we can work. So, you know, things that used to take me 4 months now take me 4 hours, you know, and that's a lot of the data analysis I do. So cleaning a data set, merging a data set, making graphs, making charts. These, you know, anybody who's worked in data or has any interest in data knows how laborious those tasks can be. But with artificial intelligence, it does all the coding, all the analysis for you. You just talk to it, and it's incredible and saves you tons of time. It really kind of has revolutionized the way I work, and it's starting to revolutionize the way lots of people work. There's no way I could have come up with all these analyses without artificial intelligence. So this is kind of also, you know, as much as Who Makes the NBA is just a book for basketball geeks, it's also a book for people interested in AI and how AI is going to change how we work. And I try to, you know, explain it for people, for beginners, kind of how you might use these tools yourself to radically improve your work performance, well, almost whatever you do.
Seth, how does this book help a NBA general manager put together a better team?
Well, I hope they'll. The chapter that I think is most useful is the draft section, where I discover all these inefficiencies in the draft. You know, I think there definitely are players that are systematically overvalued or undervalued, and if you know what things to look for, you know, even some physical traits I discover. I think that could be really, really useful for NBA teams as well. And other things, you know, I talk about, again, the section on coaches and how important coaches are and what you really want to look for in a great coach, which isn't necessarily as much about the X's and O's, but seems to be much more about the culture and what kind of culture they bring. So there are definitely lots of things that would be useful for an NBA team, but it wasn't necessarily written for just, you know, NBA general managers. It was also written, you know, I try to write books that I'd want to read, and I'm not an NBA general manager. I'm just a basketball obsessive, and I love data and love charts. So I kind of wrote it for someone like me who loves basketball, loves charts, you know, loves weird, interesting questions. And that was the target market.
Seth, do you watch a basketball game differently than other people?
After doing this research, I definitely do. You know, I'm just looking around the court and thinking about how each inch doubles your chances of making it and how taller players are worse on every dimension we can measure, athletic dimension we can measure. And, you know, thinking about where the players are coming from and why they come from these countries and thinking about the missing forwards from Brazil. So I definitely am thinking about how much a team pass is and, you know, how much the coach can influence that and how that's improving, how that leads to more team success. So I definitely am watching the game very differently. And it's more fun watching this game this way. I feel like I'm seeing things that, you know, other people maybe aren't seeing. It's really fun.
My guest has been Seth Stevens-Davidowitz. What an interesting half hour talking about his book, Who Makes the NBA? Data-driven answers to basketball's biggest questions. We have more here on Inside the Game. Stay with us. I'm your host, Pat Williams, and you're tuned in here to AM 950 and FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. We'll be right back. Seth Stevens Davidowitz, our guest in that first segment. Visiting lecturer at the Wharton School, his book, Who Makes the NBA? Data-Driven Answers to Basketball's Biggest Questions. Well, we stay on the basketball topic. We go out to Indiana. Billy Shepard. Oh, the name Shepard in Indiana basketball just gets everybody stirred up. Everybody knows the Shepherds. But Billy has a book out called Their Times in Indiana. Billy, first of all, welcome to Orlando. It's so nice to visit with you.
Same here, Pat. I appreciate the opportunity of visiting with you the next few minutes.
Tell me about this book.
Okay, first of all, you did get the title right, Their Times in Indiana. And the author of the book was actually Ed Snyder, who's been a personal friend of mine for years, a basketball junkie out of Indiana, a very successful businessman. And his role was to write the book. My role was actually to make the contacts with the players and set up the interviews with Ed. And that's kind of how that idea got started about 2 years ago.
What is Hoosier hysteria? What's that mean?
Well, it means to the folks in Indiana, I think we immediately think of basketball, but maybe in particular high school basketball. And that's what this book is all about. The players in this book told in first person their stories and their experiences about playing high school basketball in the state of Indiana. So we don't go to the college route. We don't go to the professional route. But we talk about these young players growing up in the state and what they experienced in their communities throughout Indiana.
Well, let's get started. George McGinnis.
Yes. You know, we just lost George here a few weeks ago.
Yes.
George, Mr. Basketball in 1969, maybe physically speaking, one of the finest athletes to ever come out of the state. There as well. But George, you know, he talked in the book about growing up on the west side of Indy and experiencing playing on the playgrounds and how he came to love the game of basketball, came to love his high school coach, and how that developed into a tremendous basketball career.
The Van Arsdale twins.
Oh, yes. Tom and Dick Van Arsdale. As you know, grew up on the south side of Indianapolis, actually lived in Greenwood, but attended Manual High School.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember watching them play in the state finals and as a youngster, and I don't know which one fouled out, but one of them fouled out with about 3 minutes to go. And, of course, they were tremendous players, the first brother combination, the first co-Mr. Basketballs in the state of Indiana. And they had a great career, but like a lot of the players in this book, even though the careers were fantastic, very few went on to be state champions. But McGinnis was a state champion. The Van Arsdales fell one game short.
John McLaughlin.
Well, John McLaughlin was a Franklin, Indiana player. Believe it or not, before his freshman year, Pat, my dad, who was a longtime Indiana high school basketball coach, had accepted the coaching position at Franklin, and he was to coach McLaughlin for 4 years. But he came back to Mitchell that night after accepting the job and had second thoughts and called the school board members the next day and actually turned the job down, never got to Franklin. And he was sick about that, I think, the whole next season.
My guest is Billy Shepard. Billy
ended up in Carmel, Indiana.
Billy, tell me about Eric Montrose.
Well, Eric was an Indianapolis native. He played for Jack Kiefer at Lawrence North, later played for Dean Smith on an NCAA championship team at North Carolina. And as we all know, Eric just passed away about 3 weeks ago with about a year-long battle with cancer. Just a tremendous player, one of the best big men to ever play in the state of Indiana high school basketball-wise, a seven-footer, as great a person as he was a player.
Here's an interesting name, Bobby Plump.
Well, Bobby Plump, for your fans out there, Plump was on the 1954 state championship team, the Milan Indians, a small school. As you know, Indiana had one class basketball. They upset Muncie Central in the final game. And the movie Hoosiers actually came about because of this 1954 state championship by Milan. And Angelo Pizzo, was instrumental in the movie Hoosiers. And basketball fans around the country are familiar with the movie. They may not be as familiar with Plump, but Plump was Mr. Basketball in 1954, later went on to play at Butler. And the guy's made a living over one shot over all these years, Pat. Just a tremendous person.
Was that movie Hoosiers accurate in your opinion, Billy?
I think it was fairly accurate. I really do. I love, how they went into some of the smaller schools throughout the state and kind of showed some of the regular season games, what the locker rooms were like back in those days, and Plump winding down the clock and Milan holding on to the ball until the last seconds, and then Plump hit the winning shot. So, yeah, I would say the movie did it justice.
Steve Alford.
Well, Alford is, one of the only three players in the history of Indiana high school basketball scored more than 1,000 points in one season. Of course, Steve was one of those. McGinnis was the second one, and then the third one was my brother David Shepherd, who is still the all-time leader with 1,079 points in one season. But Alford was a sharpshooter out of Newcastle. I think what fans around the country and in the state of Florida don't realize is that he played in the largest high school arena in the state of Indiana and the country, and they had over 10,000 fans for over his last two seasons there, where he played in Chrysler Arena in Newcastle. Steve played for his father, Sam, was just a tremendous scorer, but if you read in the book, his work ethic is what really got him there, and I think that's the common theme that runs throughout this book: the effort, the time, the commitment that all these players put in during their high school careers and before. Today, Pat, everything is more relegated to the AAU basketball, but in this era of this book, from the 1950s through the 1980s, AAU basketball really wasn't as big a factor. And these kids grew up, playing a lot of pickup ball, going to other schools in their general vicinity, looking for games in the summer, and that's how a lot of this came about. But Alford was one of the all-time greats, no doubt.
Billy Shepherd has helped put this book together, Their Times in Indiana. Rick Mount.
Well, as we all know, Mount was the first athlete on the cover of Sports Illustrated, high school athlete. And that was back in 1966 in the great town of Lebanon. Played for a famous coach there by the name of Jim Rosensteel. The Rocket was known for being a lifeguard in the summer, but he just worked like every other hour. He would be on duty for an hour in the park, and then he would take an hour off and go over and shoot on the outdoor court. And, a lot of people would come into Lebanon during the day, during the afternoons, just to see the Rocket shoot jumpers for an hour. And Rick was one of a kind. In my mind, Rick Mount was still the greatest shooter I ever saw play. And you might add two recent names, one a few years ago, Reggie Miller, and then today with Steph Curry. But Rick Mount was just a pure shooter and just a tremendous basketball player.
Billy, you know who I wish was alive that you could have put in this book, and that's Jimmy Rail.
For sure, Pat. I mean, the Splendid Splinter out of Kokomo, Indiana. Jimmy was a personal friend over the years. It's just too bad. He passed away a couple of years ago before we started this project, and We weren't able to talk to him, of course, but there's a guy that I think scored like 90 points in two games when he was at Indiana University in the same season against Michigan State. I mean, the guy was a threat when he stepped across the 10-second line, and very few of these players had the opportunity of playing with the three-point line. Mm. And knows how many points, Pat, a lot of these guys would have put up. But Rail was just he was just a tremendous offensive player. At 6'2", they called him the Splendid Splinter. Probably didn't weigh more than 130 pounds in high school. And he came out of a lot of games with bloody knees and bloody elbows, but he could shoot it with the best of them. And let me throw in there, too, while we're talking about this, their times in Indiana.com. This book by Ed, all proceeds go to the YMCA in Indiana. Like I said, Ed is a very successful businessman. He spent a lot of time on this book, but he's taking no credit or no money for it, and wants all proceeds to go, to the YMCAs in Indiana. And the book can be ordered online, theirtimesinindiana.com. You can go there and order the book. It has been a really good seller so far, and we're just, gaining momentum with them thanks to the time that Ed and Jill Snyder put into making this book happen.
Billy Shepherd, our guest, Their Times in Indiana. We've got to take a break. There's still many more interesting players to talk about here. Mike Warren, Randy Whitman, who had some coaching years here in Orlando. Brian Evans, who the Magic drafted. The great Dick Barnett. Kent Benson. Oh, stay with us, folks, here on Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams. It's AM 950, FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. We'll be right back with Billy Shepherd. My guest is Billy Shepherd. He's coming to us from Indiana. Their Times in Indiana is the name of the book. And as I mentioned, Billy, Mike Warren is next.
Yeah, Mike, it's been rumored over the years that of all the players that John Wooden coached at UCLA, Mike played his high school ball in South Bend, Indiana, but was recruited by Wooden. Because his high school coach, Jim Powers, had played for Wooden at Indiana State when Wooden was coach there. And Mike, like you said, the television series Hill Street Blues, he's probably more well-known for that than he was his basketball prowess. But Mike was a heck of a high school player. And like I said, when people interviewed Wooden over the years, I don't think he ever speculated out loud who his favorite player was, but there were many, many, many pictures of Wooden in a UCLA basketball sweatshirt that had the number 44 on it, and that was Mike Warren's number at UCLA. So, who knows? We'd like to know maybe who his favorite player was. I'm not saying Warren was his best player, but there must have been something about Mike Warren that Coach Wooden was drawn to that made him wear that sweatshirt over the years, Pat.
Randy Whitman.
Well, Randy was another Indiana University boy. He played at Ben Davis High School. And the thing about this book that's great, you can hear their voices and words in first person, which it just makes them feel like they're speaking to us. And Whitman was what I would call a late bloomer. Randy had a nice high school career at Ben Davis. I think the story he tells in the book is that he went down to one of Coach Knight's summer camps when he was in eighth or ninth grade. And after one of the scrimmages, Knight came up to him and kind of acknowledged him and kind of created that interest in Indiana University. And Whitman played on some nice basketball teams there at Ben Davis. But once again, I don't think he ever got to a semi-state or state tournament. But as you mentioned, had a long playing career with the NBA, but he also had a long coaching career. And Randy, I get to see him some down in Florida. I've got a place down in Fort Myers Beach, and he's about 8 miles away, and there's a lot of former Hoosier players. We get together once every other week or once a month and have breakfast or lunch, so it's a lot of fun.
John Mengelt.
Well, John Mengelt had that's a name that people that followed high school basketball in Indiana may not be as familiar with. You know, John was out of Elwood, Indiana. He was a three-sport star in high school. Elwood had their greatest teams when John was in town. His dad, I think, owned the local Dairy Queen, and John was one of these hard-nosed players, as you well know, having watched him in the NBA all those years. I think, he ended up going to Auburn, and I remember playing against John some myself in the summertime in some outdoor tournaments in Indiana, but he was a physical player, a heady player, always one of those guys that, you know, put his teammates above himself and just had a very, very successful career throughout high school, college, and pro ball.
Kyle Macy.
You know, Macy, once again, Macy was like Alfred, like myself, like my brother, you know, our dad in high school, and he attributes a lot of his success to just growing up around the game when his dad was actually coaching in Fort Wayne at an NAIA college. And when Kyle became a freshman or sophomore, Bob Macy, his dad, decided to take the job at Peru. And as we all know, Macy blossomed. And I might say that Kyle might have been a little bit ahead of his time. And I say this with this example in mind. When after his freshman year at Purdue, you know, he went to Purdue, was a Mr. Basketball. I don't think he or his dad liked the way the program was going. And this was before the portal, you know, before the, you know, you don't have to sit out a year to transfer. Kyle made the decision to leave Purdue and go to Kentucky. And I think, you know, even though you don't get a read about that in the book, it's because he just felt like Purdue did not fit his style, did not fit his tempo. And, of course, we know the results at Purdue at Kentucky when, you know, they ended up winning an NCAA championship with Kyle. And just the career he had down there was something special.
Billy, I want you to talk for a minute about the two greatest players ever to come out of Indiana High School, Oscar Robertson and Larry Bird.
Yes, I'd love talking about them. I wish they were in our book. They're not. We approached both. Oscar's a tough guy to get a hold of, but the Big O, I mean, he was one of a kind, a big guard before there were big guards in high school basketball, a Mr. Basketball in the state, leading Attucks to consecutive trips to the state finals, winning it, his second time there, you know, in college, starred at Cincinnati. He kind of, if you talk to other people in this book, a lot of them talked about their role models and their coaches, and Oscar was brought up over and over again with some of these players that played in the late 50s and early 60s and throughout the 60s that idolized Oscar Robertson. And, of course, Bird came along later. You know, Bird was one of these players a little bit like Macy. People don't realize that Bird in high school played at French Lick, a small school, made the Indiana All-Star team, was not a Mr. Basketball, was not well-known in high school, committed to Indiana University, lasted only a few weeks, Pat, at Indiana, and came back to French Lick with really no plans in mind as to what he was going to do. And I know that he worked for the sanitation department when he came back to French Lick. And there was a coach at Indiana State, an assistant coach at the time by the name of Bill Hodges, who camped out at Indiana, down at French Lick when Larry came back, begging Larry to give it one more try and come to Indiana State. And he finally convinced him to do so. A gentleman by the name of Bob King was a coach at Indiana State. He resigned or moved to another school, and Hodges became the head coach, and Larry Legend, Bird, that's where it happened after that, playing those 3 years at Indiana State. The Celtics fell out in the arena, and then we all know what happened as the Celtics drafted him after his junior year. He came back and played one more year, but yet when he went to the Celtics, they got their dynasty back, so to speak, with his years there. But two of the greatest players, different paths. Oscar was destined to become a great pro. Bird, not so, out of high school, not well known, but made it happen later in his career.
Kent Benson.
Well, Benny was the number one pick in the draft, I think, with Detroit, if not one, at number two. And he played at Newcastle before Alford. And they didn't have the big arena when he was there, but he was a man amongst boys in high school. I mean, just a guy that he could rebound, he could power people, score inside, he could hit the little bunny hooks. Just one of those players that dominated at the high school level. And I'll tell you what, had a great college career down at IU with Knight on that 76 team, played with some really good teams. And he had a good pro career, probably not the kind that people would expect, but anytime you play in that league for 8 to 10 to 12 years, you're a ball player.
Monty Tau.
Well, Monty's the smallest guy in the book. I'll give him that. I know Monty lives down in the Tallahassee area. I think Gainesville area. He's still coaching high school basketball. Monty went to a school, Oak Hill High School, which was around the Marion area where you had Dave Colescott. You had Lyndon Jones and Edwards. I mean, just tremendous players, but he was on a team at Oak Hill that upset Marion in the sectional, wasn't highly recruited, but there were some people around there that thought enough of him to recommend him to North Carolina State. And, of course, we all know that the kind of career he had there with David Thompson and that group and Burleson, Monty is a legend in Grant County, no doubt.
Tell me about Dick Barnett.
Dick Barnett, you know, I found out a lot more about him as I read his chapter in this book. Having grown up in the Gary area, I think that, and Dick will tell you himself, that early on he was one of those guys that played on the playground. He wasn't concerned about his high school academics enough, so his high school career was delayed a little bit because of that. But I think in his junior and senior year in the Gary area, you know, he came up on his own at that time. I think he attended an NAIA college down in Tennessee, continued to get better, and then the guy played, you know, forever in the NBA and with the Knicks and just had tremendous stats and had a tremendous NBA career.
Folks, my guest has been Billy Shepherd. A legendary name in the state of Indiana with basketball as his background. And we've had a good time talking about his book, Their Times in Indiana. Well, thanks for joining us here on Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams. We'll be back next weekend to talk more sports here on AM 950 and FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. Have a great week ahead and good sports to all of you. We'll be right back.
Inside the Game with Pat Williams is a pre-recorded show.